and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. How are you? Mark Riley, okay?
How you doing, man?
I'm pretty good. Kalo, Chris Lopresto's birthday today. Happy birthday to you.
Oh, that's all we can do.
Yes, all right, that's it. Enough. Dude, how old are you, man?
I'm 26.
26? Yes. Oh, that's nothing.
26?
That's nothing. You don't even have a right to be bitter yet. Are you bitter?
No,
you're
I'm not.
Right? You feel
okay.
Good? You do?
Yes.
I brought you some homemade banana bread.
Yes, thank you for that.
You know what I did this morning? I did the weird thing. You know when you have a friend of yours, it's his birthday, and you didn't do the considerate thing and actually go out and shop for something nice for him, and you start looking around your house for something you don't want anymore? I'm like, what would Chris think that's really cool that I don't need anymore?
Banana bread?
That I actually cooked.
Oh, okay. You did that.
Yeah, right. That I decided to do.
What was in the running, though?
What was in the running?
Yeah.
At this particular apartment, I don't have much, you know?
A cat?
Well, there's a lot of books that I stole from upstairs and a cat. Yeah, I could have given one to cats, but I didn't even want to part with one of those. And I started looking at some swag that I got from Tough Crowd and stuff, you know, and I thought that might be cool. And then I said, you know, I'll just give him some banana bread I made for my wife and make him think like I made it for him, and that'll be enough.
Good choice.
Yeah. Now, wait a minute. Are you 26 or are you 32? Tell the truth.
I'm 26, Riley. Why would you think I was 32?
Why would he lie
because
about
Because I thought
his
I
age?
Heard you say once that you were 31.
Why would he?
Riley, come on.
Why would he lie? Why would Chris Lopresto lie about his age? What could he possibly be getting away with? You know what I mean? Look at him.
Do you think I look like I'm 32,
Riley? I think that's what he's saying.
Sure.
Man. You need help.
Wow.
So, we got a lot of things to talk about and a tremendous amount of guests today. It's, you know, it is a huge day. We're going to be talking to a senior policy analyst with the EPA who is ready to talk the talk, man.
Yeah, man. We talked about him yesterday. He's
Hugh Kaufman is going to lay it down and what's really going on in New Orleans and what's really going to happen environmentally down there. We've got the author of 301 Smart Answers to Tough Interview Questions. It's about how do you figure out whether you're losing your job. And I got a friend who's in this situation right now, and I need to ask her some questions. And we got the guy who told Cheney to go himself. And
yeah.
What an amazing show that is. We have no time for anything, but we made
but
time.
But we made time.
We made time for our intern, Little Goliath, Dave. I know you get paid, but I'm going to call you an intern because it's better for the show. See,
fine.
And I don't want to tip the audience off to that. Now, what I want to ask you about, he came in, Dave comes in all excited today, Riley. You missed it because you were up here working.
Yeah, yeah.
He had a dream. He had a dream, revolving around our own Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman.
You dreamt about Dan Pashman?
I did.
What happened? You know,
do you date?
No.
I didn't let him. You know, I mean, maybe if you, analyze it really deeply, maybe it's, an odd,
thing.
But you know, on the surface.
Yeah, let's just lay it out. So you're in your head, and what happens?
All right. I was walking along. Sort of walking along, and suddenly Dan Pashman comes up to me and he says, I want to take you on a mission. This is a mission that we have to do. It's sort of almost like he was my, the boss intern thing going on.
Yeah.
And he said, let's get into my car.
Yeah.
So I get into his car, and it's like an SUV,
right?
But beyond an SUV.
Pashman's got an SUV?
Yeah,
was it the Batmobile or something?
Almost. it was beyond a Humvee, it was almost a Humvee. And he starts driving up a mountain.
Yeah.
And it's rocks, boulders, everything, And the wheels start morphing.
Ooh.
They start kind of changing shape so that they can actually climb this mountain.
They become almost organic.
Yeah,
was this
almost
in Staten Island?
Organic, almost like amoebas.
Was this the landfill in Staten Island? Was that what you were climbing?
It was a mountain, like a rural, almost like Yosemite Park or something.
Okay,
Okay. So finally we get up to the top of the mountain and we get out and we're hiking around.
Yeah.
And Pashman says to me, I need to check for blisters. Let's check for blisters.
Yeah. Battle gag.
Yeah. So I take off my sock and
Not falling for that twice.
Right.
Yeah.
And I have this horrible, horrible blister.
Oh.
So Dan takes out this toolkit. It's like this entire toolkit of blister maintenance, whatever.
Yeah.
And And it's like this long, sharp object, and he takes it out, and with a certain amount of enjoyment, he says, like, this is really going to hurt.
Yeah.
So he takes it, and he's about to just stick it right into the back of my heel where this blister is.
Yeah.
But instead of sticking it into the back of the heel, he suddenly lunges it up into my throat, and I can feel it. I can feel it go into it. It literally goes into my mouth.
Oh.
Like, and then he pulls it out, and he's like, just messing with you, and laughs.
Oh, my God. Dave, you're traumatized.
I woke up in a cold sweat.
Oh,
I really
God.
Did.
Pastor, you're a horrible human being, man.
Dan, what is that about?
What is that?
How have you climbed into this kid's head and ruined his sleep? Oh, my God, that's awful. So let's take a crack at it. So the mission is, obviously, the mission is Dan and you. You work here at Air America. That's the mission.
That's
Dan's
right.
Sort of your boss, kind of, right?
Yeah, would definitely. You say that? I would definitely call him.
So you're being driven in the Danmobile, which is a giant SUV with organic amoeba-like tires that are able to grab onto rocks and pull things up the hill, pull the car and you up the hill. Being driven means that you're not in control. You have to rely on Dan to sort of, you know, take you along, right?
Right,
all right,
exactly.
The blister, this is interesting. The blister means that you have a minor, there's annoyance or a problem, all right? You have a problem, and the problem is obviously Dan Pashman-based. And everyone here has had that, right? Everyone here has had a few days of Dan Pashman-based problems because there's something annoying about his optimism. You know what I mean? You know, let's just be honest. All right, so getting a blister means you need to, you know, it means that you're a little self-conscious and that you've gotten this blister because you're not putting the right amount of effort in. You did something wrong. You weren't hiking properly.
Yeah,
a little self-conscious.
No, you're right.
All right, so the hiking thing is just about the process. It's about progress. It's about achieving things. So after you drove up, now it's up to you. You know, just, you're with Dan, and you've got to, you know, kind of get it together, right? And I'm not judging. I think you're doing a fine job. I'm not sure what you do, but you're doing a great job. You bring me papers in the morning. So this is a horrendous thing. So he was going to help you with the blister, right? So he was going to help you along, you know, give you some help and advice on how to work here, and he stabs you instead. So now the stabbing thing, this is like, we could go the sexual route, but I'm not going to go the sexual route.
Okay.
I think this is reveals a little bit of a sense of inadequacy. You know, you feel a little like, you know, like, oh, no, you have too many expectations, a little overwhelmed, and the whole idea that you're needing help means you're a little overwhelmed. And that bastard, Pashman. All right, just, you know, goes out of his way right in that moment of vulnerability where he's about to help you, and he just boom, boom, because he thinks it's funny. I think what we've discovered here in your subconscious is that there's a secret little bully inside Dan Pashman. And I think that little bully was dancing on your head while you slept. And I think that I think you should resolve this. How do you feel about that, Pashman? Oh, you're in the booth. You can't talk. Maybe we'll have a Pashman rebuttal.
I don't think that's true. You know, it might be just on the surface. Like, maybe you just have a really sexual attraction to Dan Pashman.
Why do you got to go there, man? Just because it's your birthday?
No, let me just ask him. Do you find him attractive?
You know, I don't think I do, actually. I would have to really delve into
my... There's an intellectual answer for you.
I'd have to... Well, you know, I'm a believer in, you know, the subconscious and all that stuff.
A believer in it?
I mean,
you're a supporter of the subconscious?
I'm a supporter. I'm a painter guy. So I'm trying to tap in all the time. I don't think there's a
like
a sexual
I'm sitting here looking at him in the booth. Like, I mean, now that Kayla brought that up on his birthday, and now Dan's in the booth playing with his nipples, and I tried to picture him as a woman, and even then, nothing. I got nothing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, he's cute enough, and he's got good energy, but I don't find him sexy.
No, but there could be just a guy on guy connection. You know?
Even that, you know, I mean, it's a little awkward. Because he's getting a little belly, you know. He doesn't think he's getting it, but he's got this weird little belly and his like weird addiction to wrapped sandwiches. You know, I understand what you're saying. Your subconscious is very interesting, and I'm glad you shared that with us. And I think I think something with the morphing tires up the hill. I think you've got a painting there.
You've got to get to work on a Dali type painting, maybe.
Sure, sure. What?
You know. And I don't have to go to my therapist this week.
So. That's true. Michael Brown, on the other hand, is going to have to go somewhere because he's out of work, and we're going to get into that and what's going on in New Orleans and some pretty pretty dark stuff this morning. So stay with us. It's 15 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Hi, this is Phil Lesh from the Grateful Dead. One time, I was listening to Morning Sedition, and Maron started riffing on the Bush administration. Then Riley came in with a slamming groove about the right wing's use of the media. Just when you thought it couldn't get any freakier, Marin broke into Scarlet Begonias. What a sick jam. Best show ever. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
Hey, folks. We're going to be broadcasting live from Elmo Restaurant this Friday morning. Elmo is on 7th Avenue between 19th and 20th Streets here in Manhattan. We'll be there this Friday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. If you're in Manhattan and or you're thinking about driving to Manhattan, I've still got time to stop you to take public transport just because of this afternoon. The UN summit is in town today. New York has gone into a security gridlock because there's going to be like 170 world leaders descending on the city between yesterday and today for this big United Nations summit and General Assembly, which marks the 60th anniversary of the founding of the world body. So as Police Commissioner Ray Kelly said, quote, this is a General Assembly like no other, unquote, which means for New Yorkers, it's going to be a traffic issue.
Well, yeah. As a matter of fact, when I was coming downtown this morning, they were already stopping people about two blocks north of the UN as they get off the exit. So
and also people are voting in the primaries today in New York City. Just for the UN thing alone, specialized counter-terrorist units are deployed. The East River itself will be subject to temporary closures. There's going to be Coast Guards patrolling the waterway. You know, it's going to be it might be a big mess. So I say stay with public transport. That's what I say. That's what I say today. So let's get into this, Riley. Brownie's gone, my friend. Michael Brown said he had to resign, quote, because, quote, in the best interest of the agency and best interest of the president, unquote. I mean, this is no surprise considering he was sent home on Friday. And we've got a response that afternoon after the resignation of Michael Brown, the head of FEMA. George Bush was down there in Mississippi, you know, trying to, you know, help out with the damage to his image. And and he was asked, you know, if he knew about the resignation.
You accepted the resignation of Michael Brown.
I haven't
heard about it.
I have not talked to Michael Brown or Mike Chertoff. That's who I talked to. As you know, I've been working. And when I get on Air Force One, I will call back to Washington. But I've been on the move.
Gee, you think somebody would have...
Oh, God. What did that? I've been on the move. What do you think he is?
But he's trying to make himself look like I'm too busy. You know, I'm running around trying to make people like me again. So what, you're going to tell me that the President of the United States wasn't pulled aside on this press junket to Mississippi by someone and told about this? That's ridiculous. Of course he knew.
Of course he knew. And of course, the White House hung this guy out to dry. All you need to know about Michael Brown stepping down is contained in Scott McClellan's official response.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? We went from just the other day, George W. Bush said, Brownie, you're doing a great job, to Scott McClellan yesterday saying, we respect his decision to leave.
Well, yeah.
So,
well, I'll tell
simple
you,
as that.
It's pretty clear that this guy had to go. I mean, it was no doubt. You know, the entire world was coming down on this guy, rightfully so. He bungled this response to the hurricane. He is responsible for the deaths of a lot of people, and certainly for the horrendous, dire circumstances that a lot of people had to live through for almost a week down there and are still living through now. Yeah, it's going on a couple weeks, actually. And the bottom line is, this guy had to go. But this does mark the first time that a Bush, appointee was actually pushed out by Bush because he screwed up, not because of disloyalty issues. Usually these guys just get moved around or they get disappeared into the back room for a while and you don't hear from them. But this guy, he got hung out to dry because he deserved to be hung out to dry. But this is an administration that doesn't really do this to guys they like.
Oh, no, that's true. But don't cry for Michael Brown. He won't be out of work for long. Jack Abramoff or some other lobbyist will hire him from one of these firms, and he'll be making six figures.
I'd like to, you know, I bet you that may be true, but I think he's one of those guys that is completely incompetent. No matter what he'll be doing, he's going to be a liability to whatever company he's in, sort of like George Bush was throughout his his coming up. No, I'm serious.
Oh, no, I think you may be right. Maybe that horse breeder's gig is still around.
But you got fired from that.
Oh, that's right.
He didn't leave voluntarily. This guy couldn't even handle that. And the other thing that I think is important to notice here is that anybody who says Bush is stupid, you know, I've been trying to dissuade people from making that sort of observation because it's too easy. The bottom line is I think that he'd rather look stupid than accountable. I think that that's a choice he makes on an image level, that he's going to stand down there and say, I was too busy to you know, pay attention to someone resigning. Who, you know, it's just, that's ludicrous. But his decision to look stupid and incompetent, yeah, but out of touch is a choice he makes over looking accountable. He'd rather not answer questions because he's incapable of that, but he'd rather just look like, you know, I'm just a regular guy out here, you know, touching people, trying to get them to like me again. I got no time for that.
Well, you know, he seems to have gone on a bit of a tear with the reporters that were with him yesterday. He got kind of angry, it seems, when he was asked continuously about the racial aspect of the Hurricane Katrina rescue operation.
Uh-huh.
And he responded, quite angrily, in fact. And the question is, if he doesn't think race was a factor, how come so many black people think it was a factor?
Yeah, no, he. The great thing is now is that they're pressuring him and they're not afraid to pressure him. You know, with an approval rating of 38%, the press, because of this, you know, this natural disaster and the disaster of this administration's response, are really finding their guts. Now, clearly there was a racial element, but he wouldn't know how to address that. You know, he just wouldn't know how to address it.
Well, you know, he was slick with it, though. What he said was, well, no one, you know, when the helicopters came, they didn't discriminate based on who was on top of the roof, whether they were black or white. But that begs the question. The question is whether or not the response would have been identical had the hurricane happened in Florida and the population primarily white.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. And I think one of the other unspoken things that people aren't really talking about, but I think needs to be talked about today, is, you know, the bodies of 45 patients have been found at a flooded out hospital, amid otherwise, you know, encouraging signs going on down there in terms of, you know, how many people are being found and people getting sort of starting to bounce back a little bit. The elderly and people and the sick were abandoned.
Yes.
They were abandoned by the people that were watching over them, and they were abandoned by rescue efforts. So this is a horrendous thing. You know, there is the race issue, and then there's the issue of the elderly.
Yeah.
And we've got reports, you know, coming in today that, you know, some doctors actually euthanized terminal ill patients.
Scary stuff.
As opposed to let them die alone. We'll get into that. We're going to get into talk a little bit more about the press and their new set of NADs. And we're going to talk about the EPA and how ineffective it is. And we're going to talk to a real EPA guy who's ready to talk about what's really going on down there. It's 27 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Hey, in just a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Hugh Kaufman, a senior policy analyst with 35 years' experience at the Environmental Protection Agency. This is an agency not unlike FEMA that has been gutted by this administration and is just a shadow of what it once was, and they can't even do their job effectively, and our guest has had enough. He's going to talk to us about the way the water is being pumped out of New Orleans and how that increases danger to health, how the inept political hacks who are in charge of the operation down there are not allowing the EPA to do their job. The EPA isn't even included in some of the discussions about how to handle this. And one thing we're not hearing about is just all the chemical waste and chemical toxins that are going to be seeping into the ground and in the air there that could be there for years. So that's going to be a pretty engaging interview. I'm looking forward to it because it's rare that you get guys like this who are fed up and ready to talk.
Absolutely.
Here's another sad, brutal story out of New Orleans. But wait, let's have a little comedy. You know, sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, we've got the iNews Wi-Fi headline translator. It's the iNews 5000. Let's kick it up and feed it some headlines. From USA Today, some say Congress going overboard on aid. Translation, some are not sleeping on a cot in the Astrodome. Let's do it one more time. Some say Congress going overboard on aid. Translation, tax cuts for Halliburton conflict with contracts for Halliburton. Tax cuts for Halliburton conflict with contracts for Halliburton. Hey, come on, this is going to get funny in a minute. From the New York Times. Pentagon studies preemptive nuclear strikes. Translation. Pentagon seeks creative solutions to manpower problems. All right, here we go again. Pentagon studies preemptive nuclear strikes. Translation, one strike and you're out. Yay, funny. All right, from the Associated Press, same-sex marriage may stay legal in Massachusetts. Same-sex marriage may stay legal in Massachusetts. Translation, Massachusetts to remain evangelical fundraising bonanza.
Oh,
all right, one more time. Same-sex marriage may stay legal in Massachusetts. Here we go. Longest legally married gay couple may yet celebrate cotton anniversary. All right, so let's get into this. This is horrendous. Doctors working in New Orleans as the city flooded apparently shut down and became when the city like shut down and became anarchy. You know, they literally were in the position where they had to make a choice as to let the sick people that were terminally ill people that may have had days, if not, you know, less than that to live, whether to leave them there to die alone, you know, at the hands of apparently roaming hordes of drug addicts looking to break into hospital pharmacies. And just the fact that there was no power to run life support systems or anything, apparently some of these doctors went ahead and euthanized some of these terminally ill patients, gave them overdoses of morphine, and sat there with them as they died, as opposed to leave them alone in the dark, at the whims of the flooding and at the whims of these roaming hordes of or at least individuals who were, you know, hungry for drugs and breaking in and stealing things.
Now, many of you probably have not heard or read that story prior to now. The fact is, it was in the Sunday Mail in the UK. And today we see a story that there were 45 bodies found in a flooded hospital in New Orleans. Now, there is no cause and effect here. We don't know if those bodies that they found in that hospital were people who had been euthanized. We don't know that. But I just found it very strange that one day we hear about people, doctors euthanizing patients in a hospital, and the next day they find a whole bunch of bodies in a hospital.
Yeah, and just the horrendous kind of choice that some of these doctors had to make. Like one doctor said, she, quote, prayed to God to have mercy on her soul, unquote, as she overdosed dying patients on morphine for their own good. Now, you think Bush and the Christo Fascist Zombie Brigade will jump in on this issue like they did on the Schiavo issue? You think they're even going to get involved in this? Euthanasia is illegal why do I keep saying that? Because I write the abbreviation. That's a mistake that I've been making. Euthanasia is illegal in Louisiana. And I doubt that this stuff will ever make it to court. I mean, you know, I think this is a delicate, delicate matter. You know, that to make a choice like that, to have to make a choice like that, that to do something that is charitable yet, you know, horrible. Terrifying and difficult.
Yeah, and in this case, against the law. Now, the question then becomes, will any of the bodies that they found in this hospital end up being autopsied? And if so, what will they find?
Yeah, they divided patients into three categories: those who were traumatized but medically fit enough to survive, those who needed urgent care, and the dying. There apparently were patients with the do not resuscitate signs. According to a doctor, under normal circumstances, some could have lasted several days, but when the power went out, they just had nothing. They had nothing. Yeah. One doctor says, quote, I didn't know if I was doing the right thing, but I did not have time. I had to make snap decisions under the most appalling circumstances, and I did what I thought was right. This is painful stuff. Apparently, I can understand it because I am somebody who believes in this type of treatment.
Oh, you believe in euthanasia?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I also believe in one's ability to choose their own death.
See, the thing I don't understand, you know, over and above the obviously heart-rending nature of this story, is why no American media have picked it up. And obviously, in this case, the Mail, which is no tabloid, you know, scandal sheet over in England, sourced this through a doctor, sourced it through a hospital orderly, and sourced it by government officials. So it's not one of these, you know, speculative, might have happened. Apparently, this actually did take place.
Well, we're going to see how that story unfolds in the future when some of the stuff settles down there to find out how this is approached, you know, by the legal system and by, you know, just in talking to these doctors later. I find it very compelling and and heavy, not unlike you know, what else is going on down there. People don't realize that, you know, although some of the water pumping, water purification systems are working, some of the sewage systems are beginning to work down there, that what you have in the New Orleans area is, it's not just about drinking water. The area around the Port of New Orleans is referred to as Cancer Alley because there's something like 66 chemical plants or refineries, petroleum storage depots that spew out like 600 million pounds of toxic waste a year. I mean, this place is, I guess, what you call, you know, volatile in terms. It's literally a toxic dump if precautions aren't taken to stop leakage and whatnot. We don't know what's gone on, but from what we're hearing from the EPA, they are being stifled, and they are not being allowed to put the truth out there in terms of how dangerous the liquid that has become New Orleans really is.
Well, you know, a lot of that liquid has combusted in many instances, which is why you see these rashes of fires. These fires were not simply a matter of something, igniting a piece of wood or something. In some cases, this toxic soup was, in addition, flammable.
Flammable water, always bad. When we come back, we're going to talk to Hugh Kaufman, a senior policy analyst at the EPA, and he's going to tell us exactly what's going on in New Orleans, so I would stick around for that. It's 42 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
Six past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Hi.
Hey, folks, we're going to be broadcasting live from Elmo Restaurant this Friday morning. Elmo is on 7th Avenue between 19th and 20th Street. We'll be there this Friday from 6 to 9 a.m. Come down. It's going to be fun. We have a great time when we go out live. Right now, we're very excited. Our next guest is a senior policy analyst in the Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Solid Wastes and Emergency Response. He's been with the EPA for 35 years. His recent statements suggest a government cover-up could be taking place along the Gulf Coast right now. He joins us on the phone this morning from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Hugh Kaufman.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning.
I'm very good. I'm very happy you're with us. Let's get right to it.
Before we start, yes, sir. I have to tell you, my comments are based on my 35 years' experience,
yes, sir,
in the emergency response hazardous waste area at EPA.
Okay.
I was one of the people who started EPA. But I'm not telling you the policy of the Bush administration.
Okay, well, that's...
I'm not a spokesperson for them.
Thank God. Is the government, let's just get right to it and saying, is the government being honest with people about the safety of the air and water in New Orleans right now?
No, they're not. In fact, if you go to the EPA website,
mm-hmm,
and you look at the six samples that they only have six water samples taken. That's the only environmental sampling they have.
That's it. That's nothing, right?
Nothing. It was taken on September 3rd. And you look at the column for those six samples,
uh-huh,
that says sampled and none found. And in that column you see sampled and none found, benzene, toluene, and xylene.
Okay.
So according to those samples, there's no benzene, toluene, and xylene in that water. But if you watch your television set and you listen to the statements of everyone who's down there, there's an oily sheen on top of all the water down there.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's been a release of millions of gallons of oil down there.
Yep. So that means there has to be those chemicals in the water?
There is benzene, toluene, and xylene in the water. It would be the same as saying there are no atoms of hydrogen or oxygen found in water.
So now,
and if people go by this, they will think that the only thing they really have to worry about is the bacteria and viruses and not the hazardous material that's in that water.
What is the hazardous material? What are the dangers of that hazardous material being in the water in right now and for the future?
Well, you've got millions of gallons of hazardous material from oil, chemicals, from hazardous waste storage areas, from landfills, from gasoline stations. All that's in the water. That material can cause cancer, birth defects, stillborn births down the line. And in watching the television, your listeners will see that none of the heroes, the responders, are wearing respirators and protective clothing to protect themselves. We had the same problem after 9/11, where the heroes went in to try and help, were working for months in there, no respirators, no protective clothing, and now 4 years later, over 75% of those responding heroes are sick as dogs and they're starting to die off, and I'm worried that that's going to happen down the line down there, where the heroes will be the first ones to get really, really sick.
Hugh Kaufman is our guest. He's senior policy analyst at the Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Kaufman, you made a very strong statement about why certain things aren't being done. You talked about political hacks. How far up the food chain are we talking here?
Well, you've got four. Let me give you an example. At the Environmental Protection Agency, FEMA and other agencies, most of the old experienced people are being and have been driven out to early retirement, etc., because decisions are being made by people, in EPA's case, who either have no experience or have represented the chemical industries that we regulate. And FEMA, certainly, your listeners have seen that not only the head of FEMA, but the deputy directors of FEMA, as well as the head of Homeland Security, have no substantive experience in this type of field.
And that's the way they want it, right?
The way they want it. If they made it that way, I guess that's the way they want it.
Hugh Kaufman, you said that the cleanup is going to take 10 years in New Orleans. Does that mean that the city would be, in your judgment, uninhabitable for that long?
Parts of the city will be and parts of the city won't. Not all areas of New Orleans have been inundated with the floodwaters. But those areas that have been inundated with the floodwaters are going to take that amount of time. For example, the Love Canal case, which is a much smaller case, a much smaller area, less amount of hazardous material, it took us 10 years to clean that up. And that's in upstate New York. That was a case that occurred back in the 1970s. That's very small compared to this case. But I'm not just concerned about New Orleans. I'm also concerned about the other areas of contamination where you've had sewage and hazardous materials go into areas. Slidell, Louisiana, other parts of southern Louisiana, Mississippi. These places are not getting publicity, and there is no data being made available to the public on the hazardous material that's been released in those areas. It's just these are smaller areas, smaller numbers of people, but the same kind of problem that New Orleans is facing. On top of that, all of the oil and chemical companies that own storage tanks, facilities in that area that were flooded or impacted are required to publish with our regional office in Dallas instantly whenever there's a release, whenever there's a breakage from pipelines, from storage tanks, refineries.
Mm-hmm.
The regional office, under orders, is not releasing that information to the public. And the Society of Environmental Journalists has sued EPA and the federal government to try and get that information released so the public will see the full magnitude of how much toxic material they are being exposed to in that region of the country.
So Hugh Kaufman, from the senior policy analyst from the EPA, you're telling me that they have that information. The EPA office in Louisiana has that information, and you are absolutely sure that information is horrendous, but they are keeping it under lock and key because they don't want the people to know the truth of what's really going on down there a toxic level.
That's correct, and that's why the Society of Environmental Journalists are suing under the Freedom of Information Act to try and get that information.
Hugh Kaufman, very pointedly have mentioned the fact that EPA, although by law they have to be part of the cleanup, are not part of the White House task force. Explain to us why you think that is, and how is the EPA boss dealing with it?
Well, EPA is required under the National Contingency Plan response that is mandated by federal law, the Superfund law, to be responsible for cleanup, remediation, etc. You know, thus all our technical people, the ones that are still left, would be calling the shots on cleanup. However, we are not allowed, EPA is not allowed, to be part of the White House task force that makes the decision on how the New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina situation is to be resolved.
So they've taken your power away.
President, so that EPA scientists and engineers are shut out of the decision-making process on cleanup and response.
So they've gutted the agency. They've taken your power away. So on some level, when you guys see the name EPA being dragged around the press, you're feeling like, oh, my God, we don't even have the power to do what we're supposed to do.
That's correct. The working-level troops, a lot of the working-level troops who are still left, who have the experience, are just frustrated. They can't speak like I can. I'm an old guy in my 60s.
Do you fear for your job? Day. Do you fear for your job now?
No.
No?
No. I've been around too long.
Now, so let me just get this straight. I'm listening to you, and what I'm hearing is that the government, this administration has gutted FEMA, has gutted the EPA. The guys on the ground from EPA cannot do their jobs appropriately because they are being not allowed to do them by this.
And the budget cuts, we don't have enough guys on the ground.
And then on top of that, so you guys have information that they're not letting you release, so the government is actively lying to the people about what is going on there, and that is their policy now.
That's the policy as of last night at 11 o'clock when I went to sleep.
And that is the policy that happened in 9/11 as well, isn't it, Hugh Calvin?
Same policy in 9/11. That's correct. That's why there are billions of dollars of lawsuits as a result of 9/11 because of the government cover-up. Now, you forgot one other problem. In 9/11, for the real dirtiest of cleanup, government contractors hired migrant workers, people who can't speak English, undocumented workers, to do the heavy cleanup with no protective gear. And they paid them slave wages, $1 an hour.
And that might happen again in New Orleans.
Well, that won't happen. That's illegal in New York. It has been made legal in New Orleans.
Wow.
Because the president, by executive order, abolished the Davis-Bacon Act.
Okay. Well, Hugh Calvin, you've given us a lot of information. I really appreciate you sharing what you know with us. And, we're going to do everything we can to put the message that you gave us out to the people.
That's wonderful. That'll help the people by getting the word out of what's really going on.
Thanks
that
for
puts more pressure to help the public.
Thanks for being with
us,
Hugh Calvin. It's Air America Radio's Morning Edition, 57 past the hour.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
Look what's happening in the world, my friends. If you're just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for Morning Sedition's Cliff Notes. FEMA Director Michael Brown tenders his resignation. Apparently, he thought his resignation would get turned down a couple of times, like Donald Rumsfeld. Brown says his resignation is effective immediately, which in his world means, 4 or 5 days from now. He was last seen riding away off into the sunset on an Arabian horse. Terrorist Abu Musab al-Zarqawi called Hurricane Katrina an answer to Muslims' prayers. Zarqawi says the hurricane was caused by thousands of Iraqis praying for a catastrophe to strike the United States. Some of them, he said, even had the foresight to also pray that an idiot would be in charge of FEMA. Sony gives a $3.6 million record deal to a 12-year-old boy. The 12-year-old boy will sing many songs he chose or composed himself, including such ballads as Beans, Beans, the Musical Fruit, and Comet, It Makes You Vomit.
Ooh.
Classics. Those are your Morning Sedition Cliff Notes for today. Folks, that is true. What I do tell you is true. If you're just waking up and you didn't know that, I would be amazed if you didn't know that and you're listening to our show. But nonetheless, I'll give you the information anyways. Brownie's gone, my friends. Yesterday, Michael Brown said he has resigned, quote, in the best interest of the agency and best interest of the president, that agency being FEMA, of course. This is no surprise, certainly, because he should have resigned. And he was sent home Friday like a child who didn't know what he was doing, who is guilty on some level for the deaths of many people in New Orleans and the continuing discomfort and horrendous tragedy of what's going on there today. Bush was asked about his resignation when he was down in Mississippi. Can we hear what he had to say there, Chris?
You accepted the resignation of Michael Brown.
I haven't
heard about it.
I have not talked to Michael Brown or Mike Chertoff. That's who I talked to. As you know, I've been working. And when I get on Air Force One, I will call back to Washington. But I've been on the move.
That's George Bush down in Mississippi trying to help repair his image. He was out there, sort of walking around, touching people, holding people, making it look like he was doing something. And he basically did something interesting happened there, Riley. He said, I talked to Michael Chertoff, and I haven't talked to him today. And
yeah.
he knew, though. I mean, he had to know. He's the damn president. He was briefed on this. They discussed this. I mean, when Karl Rove told him it was going to happen, I'm sure he knew it was going to happen. So I think that what you need to do from this point on is never call George Bush stupid. Just realize that he's a guy who is willing to behave and act stupid as opposed to be accountable. This is his game. It's easier for him to say, I was busy down here, you know, touching black people. I don't know what's going on. I'm busy.
Well, that is the image he is trying to project to the American people, that he's busy, that he's moving forward, that he's on top of things. It was obvious.
On top of things, no.
Well, that's what he's trying to project.
Yeah.
And everybody knows he wasn't on top of things the day of and in the immediate aftermath of the hurricane. But this is his way of trying to make reporters believe that he is now trying to fix things. And that's part of this ongoing thing. We know that Rove put it together over a week ago. It's part of an ongoing political agenda and initiative to get himself off the hook.
Let me ask you a question. If he were on top of things, wouldn't he have said, yes, I heard that Michael Brown told me he was going to resign this morning, and I think it's the right thing to do because clearly he screwed up?
Absolutely not. Because by saying, I don't know because I'm too busy, I'm on the move, it makes it seem as though he doesn't have time to deal with that kind of foolishness. He's too busy trying to help people.
To me, it makes him look like an incompetent ass.
I know, but he's not just doing this for you. He's doing this for millions of Americans that will hear him say this and believe him. And believe that he's not, that he's too engaged in the situation in New Orleans or in Biloxi or wherever to pay attention to the fact that a guy he just last week said was great, he just now got rid of.
So, in other words, if he were to say that, I know that Michael Brown stepped down, then he would be forced to answer a whole strew of questions about, whether or not he regrets putting him in power, whether or not the guy had the right credentials, why'd you pick him, all those things, that becomes a wall. He has built a wall to any of those questions or having to be accountable for anything in his choice of putting Michael Brown in that office.
Absolutely. And it took away from answering that way would have taken away from him the opportunity to say, I'm the action president, because that's what he was trying to
say. And I tell you, it's great that the news that now journalists have a new set of nads. This hurricane, this disaster, and the plain and obvious incompetence of the administration to react has given a whole bunch of journalists their nads back. And it's an amazing thing, because now with the approval rating of Bush down around 38%, what's happening is Republicans are starting to say, this guy is bad.
Yeah.
This guy's no good. He's incompetent. I don't know why he's lying to us. Why weren't more things done for these poor people, for the people in New Orleans, for the elderly, for the people who were below the poverty line? Why weren't things done? This is America. And even Brian Williams had this great quote from this interview that he did. He said about the situation at the Superdome, this is Brian Williams, he said, quote, I refuse to believe that anyone I met at the Dome has any lesser value than anybody in my family that I go home to. I don't believe that about this country. I don't want that to be the lesson in this. I was angry. People were going without and dying in the wealthiest country the world has ever known, end quote. And that's a guy. Why wouldn't it be nice if the president had said something like this? This is a reporter that was down there in the middle of it, putting his own ass on the line to get the truth about what was going on down there. And now he's like, he's risen to nobility, Brian Williams.
Oh, yeah, Brian Williams. And see what he's done. Brian Williams from NBC, by the way, is who we're talking about here. He has stepped into a vacuum in network news. Remember, CBS doesn't have a permanent replacement for Dan Rather. And, of course, ABC doesn't have a permanent replacement for Peter Jennings. So Brian Williams, this is a seminal moment for him in terms of his career as a news anchor. Yeah. This is the thing that is going to solidify his chops, just like Rather's Vietnam reporting solidified his chops and his Afghanistan reporting.
Sure, yeah, and a lot of guys. There's a lot of cable guys, too, that that came up out of this and were speaking the truth. Oberman.
Oberman, yeah. Sure, Oberman. I give him a lot of credit because... Yeah.
Anderson Cooper even, yeah, you know,
even
stepped up a little bit out of the floodwater.
And then there was the legendary... Wolf, so poor, so black, Blitzer.
Yeah. Hey, you know, Riley, sometimes it's not easy being a liberal. We all stray from the straight and narrow from time to time, but when we need to unburden ourselves, we can always confess our liberal sins. If you want to take a turn in the liberal confessional, give us a call at 866-303-2270. But right now, it's my turn. Bless me, Brother Riley, for I've sinned.
How can I ease your burden, my son?
Well, you know, of course I feel awful about the hurricane.
Yes, as we all do. But I'm assuming you've personalized it, so in some weird way, it's all your fault?
I wish, you know. All right, okay, touche, you got me. I just feel so distanced from it. I was on vacation for 2 weeks when it happened. And
God complex aside, you know there's no way you can influence nature, don't you, Mark?
Yeah, I know. But in some ways, I wish I could have moved the date of the hurricane. That's what I feel guilty about. I mean, I wish it hadn't happened. But if it had, I wish it had been scheduled when I was here and I could do something to help, you know?
Well, you know, that's totally noble, Mark. You wish you'd been here to help.
Well, that's where it gets weird. I mean, I wish I'd been here to help, but I also felt... I felt a little weird about Brendan and Pashman covering for us. And,
yeah, you know, I saw that coming.
But, I mean, nothing against them, Riley. It was the right thing to do, but, I mean, I was, you know,
Wish you'd done the right thing, which is what? Come back? In case of a national emergency?
Exactly. You know, instead of going to Hawaii or having a barbecue with my friends and my wife at my house in L.A., I wish I'd been here. Yeah, but not so much. I mean, I wish that...
Yeah, you just wanted to be perceived as selfless, even though you're not.
At all, really.
There's only one penance I can see coming out of this one.
Hit me, Brother Riley.
You just have to do all you can now. Make sure people know how to donate their money to the tragedy. Make sure people know how to express their unhappiness with how the Bush administration has handled the whole thing.
All right. Well, that seems easy and, you know, good. So I shouldn't feel bad?
Oh, no. You should feel bad. That's why I want you to sleep in your bathtub for the next 2 weeks and fill it with water. And if there's any sewage around, toss that in there, too. Mm. Now go forth and sin. No more.
Okay. Amen. Well, thank you, Brother Riley. Now, if anyone else out there wants to confess and seek absolution in our liberal confessional, you can give us a call right now at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. We'll talk with you in a minute. I hope it's not as bad as mine. 15 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Call us at 866.
Ha! That's awesome. Go on.
303.
Wow, yes. Yes, I love it.
2270.
Oh, yeah, drop the bomb. Drop it. There's not a dry eye in the house. Keep going.
That's 866-303-2270.
Okay, well, just so you know, it was good, but I was also being pretty generous.
This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
We're plowing through it today. We've got the confessional booth open. It's 866-303-2270. We'll take your calls in just a second. We'll be broadcasting live from Elmo Restaurant this Friday morning. Elmo's on 7th Avenue between 19th and 20th. We'll be there this Friday from 6 to 9 a.m. It's very fun. Come down and hang out with Mark and I. And since it's a smaller venue, you may be able to touch Pops Riley.
Not in this life.
Oh, there you go. Breaking people's hearts,
yeah,
crashing
right.
Their dreams to the ground.
No, I mean, I shake hands with people. Listen, I don't want people to get the wrong impression.
I saw you signing some boobs.
Oh, yeah, thanks a lot. My wife is up.
I'm kidding. He wasn't signing boobs. We were doing it's some
nice T-shirts is as far as
T-shirts,
I go.
T-shirts, that's right. T-shirts that will eventually, you know, go over the boobs with the name. But anyways, what I'm going to say right now, do you want to know if you're going to be fired? Can you tell? Are you starting to feel like you might be about to be fired. Well, we're going to have a guest in a few minutes that's going to tell us what those signs are. Vicki Oliver, who is the author of 301 Smart Answers to Tough Interview Questions, will be with us. But let's hear some confessions, because mine was pretty hairy. All right, Mac, streaming in Seattle, which you have to do now. How are you, Mac? How can I help you? What is your confession, my friend?
How you doing, Mac?
Hi, Mark and Mark.
Yeah. What's your sin?
I work at a toy store,
mm-hmm.
and someone came, a new employee came to work there,
mm-hmm.
And she was telling me about her life. She's a veteran,
mm-hmm.
Who had served in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
and just kind of from her mannerisms,
mm-hmm.
and kind of, she had short hair, and mm-hmm. I just assumed that she was a lesbian.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the fact that she came up with G.I. Joe dolls going, all right, go. Okay, good.
Yeah.
So you assumed she was a lesbian, sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
And later in talking to her and getting to know her, I did find out that she was.
Okay.
And, you know, she told a story of how she met the person she was with in Iraq, and it, you know, it was great.
Yeah.
It's actually a very moving story. I don't want to get into it. That's, you know, her business.
Okay,
but,
let's back up a little bit. So you were right.
Yes.
And you feel guilty. Why?
All right. Okay, I understand that. But, because, you know, the assumption there.
Okay, so when you first saw her, your first reaction was like, oh, my God, she's gay. Now, let me just see if I'm understanding. And then you hit on her. And found
no.
out. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. You didn't hit on her.
I'm kidding. But you're mad at yourself because you don't want to make snap judgments.
Right. This is kind of the ultimate phase of liberal guilt. Is,
yeah.
You know, feeling bad for something that I was correct about.
Yeah, that is the ultimate phase of liberal guilt. And it's also why we are, you know, rendered powerless many times.
Yeah.
Well, look, I think that what you're going to have to do is just in some, you know, weird, unsolicited way, just, you know, go up and start telling her weird stuff about yourself.
There you go.
You know, I mean.
Personal stuff?
Sure, why not?
Okay.
Because I'm sure she's made snap judgments about you. And, you know, I just think you would feel better if you go tell her something that, you know, you maybe, since you do a lot of thinking, clearly, why don't you just make some snap judgments and assumptions about what you think she's thinking, and then go reconfirm those thoughts that you think she's thinking, just to see if she'll go, oh, my God, I thought that about you.
That'll
you,
work.
Did you understand all that?
I'll think about it.
All right, Mac, I'm just trying to help out. But yeah, take it easy on yourself. And, you know, I mean, you work in a toy store, for God's sakes. That's fun. Right?
Right.
Okay. Thanks for calling, Mac.
He sounds convinced about that part.
I hope I helped him. That is a very odd bit of business.
Yeah, it is.
Because I do that. I make snap judgments all the time. Constantly.
Most people do.
You have
most
to.
Most human beings make judgments based on appearance, obviously given the history, based on skin color, based on a whole bunch of different
things. Yeah, who doesn't? The only time you don't is when you're so completely consumed with yourself that you don't have the time to do it, or you don't even think to do that because you're constantly worrying about, like, how do I look? What am I doing? Is this okay? Am I all right? Welcome to my world.
Well, yeah, I don't have time for you. I'm busy with me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Do you remember the day back in the day when you used to get, you know, a little high sometimes, you know, and smoke a little pot, and you'd walk into a party and go, oh, my God, they're all talking about me. They're looking at me. And you get into that situation where you just walk out to people and go, sorry, man, but I'm high. And they go.
No, it didn't exactly go down that way with me. It was on a subway.
Right. And they say, really? We wouldn't have never known. You're like, oh, I'm an idiot. All right, here we go. Who we could? Tom in Los Angeles. Tom, what is your sin, Tom?
Hey, Tom.
Oh, man, I feel awful.
Why? What's the matter?
Uh-oh.
Did you cause the blackout?
Yeah, right? Are you the utility worker?
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I could confess to, like, cutting that cable and sit there going, hey, sorry to the 3 to 8 million people that I just blacked out.
So you weren't
that
good.
I ain't that way. No. The thing that I feel really horrible about is Condi Rice.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of looks hot to me.
Yeah!
That's not funny, man. That whole chocolate chip thing, that gets me crazy.
What? Chocolate chip? What's that?
Oh, the little freckles and the hair flip on the thing. And then
freckles on her.
Saturday Night Live. Who's that girl on Saturday Night Live?
I don't know. You're
Maya Rudolph.
Maya Rudolph. Okay. Yeah. You like her too?
I have to leave the room when she comes on.
Oh my God.
Is this Robert De Niro?
This is a dangerous obsession you got going on here. My goodness.
Hey, buddy. So you feel guilty because you think Condoleezza Rice is hot, and you feel guilty for liking someone portraying Condoleezza Rice in a skit, and she's also hot?
Oh, man. I want to hop on that. I want to hear, the Russian in my ear.
Yeah. Wow. I think you're going to have to... what we generally do in this situation, which we've had before, is suggest that people fantasize about Madeleine Albright for a week. Yeah, and try to erase
it. That'll end it.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, Tom, I'm sorry, but that's what you're going to have to do. Thanks for calling. Thanks for sharing your confessions. Really appreciate it.
Chocolate chip.
I've never heard that before. I wonder if he made that up. If you haven't heard it, he's probably made it up.
I don't know, man. I've never heard it.
Yeah, that would be freckles on light-skinned black woman's skin.
Condoleezza Rice ain't light-skinned.
Okay.
I guess.
So then it's freckles on a... All right, we got to go. 27 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning's Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey,
folks. This Friday we'll be broadcasting live from Elmo Restaurant. That's Friday morning. Elmo's on 7th Avenue. I'm stumbling over the S's and the TH's. And 7th Avenue between 19th and 20th, and we'll be there Friday morning from 6 to 9. That is the time we're on the air, and it's going to be fun because we have fun when we do the live performance thing.
Oh, yeah.
Right now, look, folks, if you're worried that you might be on the verge of getting fired, then listen to our next guest. There are warning signs before you get the axe, and if you know what they are, you might be able to avoid getting a pink slip. You can run away before that happens. She's the author of 301 Smart Answers to Tough Interview Questions, and she joins us here in the studio. Good morning, Vicki Oliver.
Hi, nice to see you.
It's nice to see you. Now, I got a friend, and I need to ask you right out of the gate about this getting fired thing. I had a friend, he works in radio.
Right.
Okay. He's actually, he works on another show.
Right.
And, you know, he's having some trouble at work. And, for instance, the head of the company, his boss,
right,
will not have a meeting with him. Is that something to worry about?
I think it is a problem, yeah. I mean, before layoffs,
yeah,
it's in the air. People always say it's the writing on the wall, but actually it's in the air.
Yeah.
I mean, rumors are flying.
Sure.
Doors are closed.
Yeah.
You know, people are gossiping. You know, somehow, the mailroom guy knows all the gossip, even though, the top executives don't know the gossip.
Oh, my God.
You know what I mean?
So I got to tell my friend about this. So now, also, he's telling me that the boss is not even, talking to him. They walk by each other.
Right.
And the boss won't
eyes
even
averted.
Look at
him. Right,
right.
Yeah.
Is that a bad sign?
Yeah, I hate to tell your friend, I think it could be a bad sign.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, sometimes there's a list that circulates in the company.
Okay.
And it's some people are going to be cut and some people are going to be spared.
Is that what if there's a mix-up at a company? There's a lot of new people coming in and that?
Generally speaking, new people who come in are safe. Contrary to popular belief, if they have just arrived, they are usually safer than people who have been there for a long period of time.
Wow.
It's very bad PR to hire somebody and then fire them a month later.
It
doesn't work.
So this friend of mine I'm talking about, he's actually the host of a morning show. So you think that...
you guys are safe, right?
Yeah, no. So you think if this guy went on the air and started talking about these problems he's having at work, that would maybe make his situation worse?
I do. I think that would be a really, really bad idea.
Man.
The best thing to do if you are in that situation, I think you have to take the closed door approach yourself. He has to somehow sequester his boss or maybe somebody else in the company who's a mentor to him.
Right.
And ask that person point blank, hey, am I on the list? Do you think I'm going to get it? Is there anything I can do proactively to prevent it?
Hold on, I got
to
write this down just so I can tell him.
Okay.
Now, I mean, if you don't get the opportunity to buttonhole somebody to find out that way,
right?
What if you do want to know? What would be the smartest thing to do to find out without everybody knowing you're trying to find out?
Okay. First of all, I believe that you always know.
that you're going to get fired.
You know what I mean? I feel like if you feel it, it's probably 99% chance that it's going to happen. Now, you may have a bad vibe because, let's say, a good mentor of yours is about to be fired, and it's not you, and it passes by. But I generally feel that people know when they are going to be. The best action to take if you can't find a person who can let you know, I mean, don't set off a panic attack. You know, if you're working in a company, a big company, keep your door open, keep your head down, work late, keep your cell phone on vibrate.
Yeah.
Okay, contact your headhunter, but don't do it obviously. Don't keep your door closed. And whatever you do, if you're working at a big corporation, don't look for a job on your company's email account, because it is legal for companies to check their employees' emails accounts, and they can find out if you're looking.
So generally, you shouldn't stand in the middle of the office and go, "Who's lying to me? I want to know what the hell is going on here, because I'm freaking out."
I don't think that's a great job salvaging strategy, no.
All right, then I blew it. Yesterday was a bad idea. Why the hell did I do that?
Keep in mind, too, that, you know, doors are closed, and if your door is always closed, then people think that, you know, there's a lot to perception and reality, and the list keeps changing as it gets closer and closer and closer. Some people may be lobbying to keep you. Other people are like, get rid of her, you know. So it is bad to show that you yourself are panicked. That is a very bad strategy, no matter what.
I'm not freaking out, but, you know, I'm just...
oh, Lord.
So let me ask you, though. So what you're saying to me reveals that usually in most structures, most hierarchies, most work bureaucracies, that everybody is pretty much scrambling to protect their own ass, and usually there's only one guy that can really make any real decisions.
No, actually, a lot of times it's a team. It's a team of people, and they're like, oh, you know, we have to cut, you know, X... hundreds of thousands of dollars from our budget this
year.
Right. You know, from salaries. Okay, we lost an account. We lost a client. Something happened, right? Something bad happened. We have to cut, like, a number of people. And then, because times are politically correct, those people have to be a wide range of ages. Right. You know what I mean? They can't all be women. It can't all be women over 40.
So you got to fire with diversity?
Fire with diversity. So that's a great expression, fire with diversity. Let's be fair about the way we fire people, okay? So sometimes what's chronically unfair is that somebody that did nothing wrong and got great, you know, the receptionist could be canned, you know,
because
she's making $20,000 or $25,000. You know what I mean? She fits a certain...
Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about the other side of what the book is about interviewing.
Okay.
About, you know, going out on job
interviews. Yeah, definitely if you lose your job, you have to learn how to interview.
Going on an interview,
You have to interview
Or just give up and fall off the grid. Like so many Americans have in this economy and this administration. Yeah, see that? Yeah, see, I bring it around. And...
Yeah, see?
All right, look, folks, let's continue to talk to Vicki Oliver here about interviewing. Her book, 301 Smart Answers to Tough Interview Questions. What are some tips? You walk in, you should probably wear pants.
I think that a good strategy in terms of the way you dress is to find out how people at that company dress, and then dress 25% more professionally than you would have to if you were working there already.
So, like, say, at a company that's maybe, you know, it's a right-wing company and they wear polished shoes, why not just wear jack boots and a full...
No.
Okay. Right,
you do what they do a little bit sharper, a little bit more professionally.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then once you're working there, you can bring it down.
That doesn't look desperate?
No. It shows them that you understand the dress code and that you're respecting your interviewer.
So what about, okay, so you sit down and there's a guy that's interviewing you and he says, why do you want this job? What do you do?
Okay.
Do you just start kissing up immediately?
No, I mean, it's good to do a bit of kissing up, yes. Uh-huh. But generally speaking, I think that the biggest mistake that candidates make is that they don't do their homework on the companies. And so the time to learn about the company is before you walk in. You know?
Not when you're looking at the products as you walk down the hall.
Right. Yeah, you know, posters, help. What does this company do?
Right,
you know?
Right.
No, you have to get online, research them, find out their corporate culture.
Mm.
You know, get into the head of the interviewer who's meeting with you and then spit some of that back to him.
Mm. Vicki Oliver, one thing I think that a lot of people get upset about when it comes to interviews is the question of what, you know, you can say, well, what your strength is. And most interviewers, I guess, will ask that. But then they ask, what is your major weakness or what is your weakness?
Right.
What kind of mistakes do people make in answering that specific question?
You know, about 5 years ago, probably 90% of the candidates out there would say, I'm a workaholic, right? Mm-hmm. And that seemed to pass, okay, because books like mine suggested that they say that, you know? And so every single person in the world, that's their biggest weakness, they're a workaholic, right?
Yeah.
And eventually, right, yeah. And eventually interviewers turned around and said, hey, you know, we've heard this answer before. You know, what's your real weakness? And the problem today is if you go in and you say, I'm a workaholic, they're going to be like, okay, that's a strength. You know?
Right.
You know, what's your weakness?
Right.
So what I advocate in the book is actually coming up with a real weakness, but not a huge one. Like, you don't steal the company pencils, okay?
Right.
You're
right.
Not a kleptomaniac, okay?
Right.
That is a bad weakness to admit to, okay? But I think that a good weakness might be, you know, I'm impatient, and here are the steps that I'm working on to solve my impatience, you know, and maybe bring up a self-help class that you're taking.
So you just bring this up out of nowhere? What kind of question
would
provoke that?
Well, I think you have to look
that?
Inside. Well, what's your biggest weakness, Vicky?
Oh, I see.
You know,
okay.
I'm impatient.
Yeah.
You know, I like to do things quickly. I don't have a lot of patience.
So you should say, I'm impatient. Can we speed this up?
That would be good. And also, you know, that's a really good point, Mark. If you're in an interview and you can lighten things up, you definitely should.
Okay.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you want to bond with the interviewer, and the fact that you're already in the interview probably means that you're already qualified for the job.
Right.
So then the key is bonding with the person.
Okay.
Now, what happens, and I think a lot of people have gone through this too, what happens you get like maybe 5-10 minutes into an interview, and you suddenly realize that the interviewer is not completely focused on the interview anymore.
Yeah.
That they've, you know, they've been talking to 10 people during the course of the day.
Right.
You're number 9.
Right.
And suddenly the pro forma questions just seem to be coming out, and there doesn't seem to be any active engagement.
Right.
What do you do to make yourself stand out?
I think that's
out?
A fantastic question. I think you have to break through, you know, whether you stand up, you know.
Yeah.
Whether
look
you,
at me.
Whether you can, let's say there's some art on the person's wall.
Oh, yeah.
You might comment on it. You need to do something to break through. So that, you know, especially let's say the guy is writing notes while you're there.
Yeah.
You know, if they're writing notes, they're not paying any attention to you.
You should maybe say, like, hey, stupid.
No, I wouldn't do that.
What if they ask you, like, really personal questions? Like, you know, what do you answer them honestly? Do you try to say what you think they want to hear, you know?
I think that personal questions, first of all, most of them are illegal.
Okay.
Which is very interesting. Like, if somebody says, are you married? That's kind of an illegal question.
It's an illegal question?
Is that true?
It's an illegal question because it's like, that has no bearing on your ability to do the job, you know? And same if they say, oh, do you have kids? I mean, you may not have a problem saying, hey, yeah, I've got 3 kids, in which case, fine, say it. But it is not, you know, they shouldn't be asking you that because it doesn't bear on your ability to do the job. The problem is if you say, hey, can you ask me that? You're not going to get the job, you know? So you have a couple of choices. You can either answer the question if it doesn't bother you that much and say, yeah, I've got, you know, a couple kids. Or you could be a little bit charming and you might say, you know what, I tend to think of the projects that I'm working on as my kids.
Uh-huh.
You know, what projects do you have going on here? Like, get back on track.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Another way to do it is to be very monosyllabic.
Yeah.
I mean, not be impolite, but be monosyllabic. You know, are you married? No. Or yes.
Right.
You know, and then there's a gap. And so they have to fill in with a different question.
Yeah, and so I guess that it's all a legality thing. But if you really want the job, and they start doing that, do you take legal action? Or
No. The worst thing to do, I think, is to become like a legal beagle. Like, you don't want to do that because it's just going to hurt your chances. Here's the deal: try to get the job. Like, no matter, even if you hate the person, you know, try to be offered the job and then decide whether or not you can deal with taking it.
Well, look, you know, it's been great talking to you, Vicky Oliver. The book is 301 Smart Answers to Tough Interview Questions. You know, you help me, you know, I'm going to go start interviewing.
Nice talking to both of you.
Thank you.
Good luck with the book. It's 46 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Is it possible for you to shut the fuck up for 10 seconds?
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
51 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
Hey, folks, on Friday we'll be broadcasting live from Elmo Restaurant. Elmo's on 7th Avenue between 19th and 20th. We'll be there from 6 to 9 this Friday. That's 6 to 9 in the morning, of course. Come on down. People fly in from around the United States to come see Mark and I do our show. We had a guy come in from, where was he from? Minnesota.
Was it Minnesota or Madison, Wisconsin? Oh, yeah.
Wisconsin. Yeah. Madison, Wisconsin. That's right. That was his name was Terry. He came down all the way down just to hang out last Friday at the new school. That was a great show. We're going to have a lot of fun. A lot of fun this Friday at Elmo Restaurant. Where's my dad? My dad was supposed to drop by the studio. He's in town. He said he's taking a bus from Jersey. Just like my whole life, Riley. Where's my dad? He's late to pick me up.
Nah, he's stuck in traffic. He's stuck in traffic. Give him a break. It's rush hour.
Daddy's at work. I know how this goes.
He's on the east side of Manhattan. Maybe he's stuck in General Assembly traffic.
That's true. New York has gone into security gridlock with 170 world leaders descending on the city for the United Nations Summit and General Assembly. This one is marking the 60th anniversary of the founding of the world body. So Police Commissioner Ray Kelly says here in New York, quote, this is a General Assembly like no other, unquote, which means it's going to be a little crazy. The president's flying in today. Specialized counter-terrorist units are being deployed. The East River might be closed down for a little while. The U.S. Coast Guard is here. They're going to have federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies doing all their jobs. And there's going to be street closures. And on top of that, today is voting day.
Primary day here. Near. By the way, I saw one of those Coast Guard cutters in the East River as I was coming downtown this morning. Yeah, man, a big one with the big blue lights and stuff.
Uh-huh.
They are patrolling the river, but it is primary day. The polls are open. Those of you who live in the five boroughs of New York,
do it.
There is a Democratic primary, four contenders, Fernando Ferrer, Anthony Weiner, Gifford Miller, and C. Virginia Fields.
All of them have been on our show in the last few months, our live broadcast. I'll tell you, I was pretty impressed with Anthony Weiner, and it seems like he might be the guy that has the juice to push for a runoff.
Into a runoff. Yeah, let me, for people who don't live in New York, help you know a little bit about our political system here in the city. In a mayoral primary, if you do not get 40% of the vote, there is a runoff between the top two contenders 2 weeks from today.
Mm-hmm.
And the polling going into today's balloting, and of course the polling can always be wrong, but the polls are saying that it's going to be a runoff between Fernando Ferrer, the former Bronx Borough President, and Congressman Anthony Weiner. Now, the X factor is that the Reverend Al Sharpton, who had sat by the sidelines through most of the campaign, decided this past weekend to endorse Fernando Ferrer based on his opposition to the fact that Anthony Weiner supported the war in Iraq.
Okay, now let me ask you a question about Al Sharpton and why this guy is so pivotal and important in this city. What is it about Al Sharpton that how many votes is he able to deliver, and why is he able to deliver votes?
Okay, he is able to deliver votes because he connects with a segment of the population that listens to what he has to say and acts on it.
I got to be honest with you. Al Sharpton has amazed me with his linguistic virtuosity and his guts. I mean, he does say stuff that makes you go, finally somebody's saying something.
Well, yeah, and he's also got an organization, and it is not the kind of sophisticated vote-pulling operation that a lot of other, like the unions have in New York,
mm-hmm.
but he does have an organization. The problem with Sharpton in the most general sense, and I said I spoke to him last night, actually.
You did?
Yeah, I did, mm-hmm. To talk to him a little bit about what was going on with all this. But anyway,
That's it? That's all you're going to give us, Riley? Here we are. We're going to speculate about Al Sharpton. Like, I talked to him last night, but that's not important to me, talking about Al Sharpton.
We talked about what his reasons were, and I mean his main reason was the war.
Okay.
All right. It's an international event. He really felt that Anthony Weiner and he saw Anthony Weiner surge in the polls and said, you know what, I got to get on board with Fernando Ferrer.
Okay.
So now you have a situation where if everything goes the way it seems it's going to go, it'll be Weiner and Ferrer in a runoff. Now that's not guaranteed, but that's what the polling is starting to say. But the big person that's looming over all of this is the incumbent mayor, Michael Bloomberg, who has approval ratings above 50% with every group with the exception of Latinos and Bronx residents.
Okay, now let's talk a little bit about this, because all you've been hearing is that Bloomberg's unbeatable. He's got, a 64% approval rating across the board, something like that.
A 54% approval rating among blacks. That's unprecedented for a Republican mayor.
But why is this? And first of all, why is it? And second of all, Riley, is he beatable? I mean, do things like that happen?
Look, this is New York politics. anything can happen.
Well, what would it take to beat Mike Bloomberg, really?
It would take a, first of all, a unified Democratic Party behind a particular nominee, whichever one it turns out to be, and that nominee would have to find Mike Bloomberg's Achilles heel, which I'm not sure they found yet.
Okay, so there's still time to do that.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that's encouraging for Freddie Ferrer is that he has a majority of people who earn less than $30,000 a year in New York.
Okay.
That is where he could theoretically mine a victory over Mike Bloomberg should he win the primary, and that's not a given yet.
We'll talk about losing the unions, the big unions.
Yeah, the big unions went with Mike Bloomberg. Mike Bloomberg negotiated deals, new contracts with many of those unions, including DC 37, the largest municipal employee union in the city. And, you know, the payback was they endorsed him, and they endorsed him early. And the head of DC 37 is a black woman, Lillian Roberts, who's been around forever. So this is a very different race this year than most of the previous years, and I've covered elections in this town back to 1973.
Well, it sounds like it's going to get exciting, at least with these Democratic primaries.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll see what happens as this unfolds. When we return, we are going to have a conversation with Dr. Ben Marble. Do you know who Dr. Ben Marble is? Well, you remember last week, the guy who told Cheney to go himself? That's Ben Marble, and he's going to tell us the story behind why he told Cheney to go himself. All right, it's 57 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
How are you, Mark?
I'm doing all right.
You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Folks, if you want to come down and hang out with us live, we'll be broadcasting from Elmo Restaurant this Friday. Elmo is on 7th Avenue between 19th and 20th. We'll be there from 6 to 9 a.m. Come on down. Touch Pops Riley.
Oh, no.
He'll sign your shirt or something. Yes, hey, folks, you know, in a few minutes, the games have begun. A confirmation of John Roberts' hearing opened today, and boy, what a cluster in
Uh-oh.
Terms of, you know, people, you know, senators rambling on about what they want, what they say they're going to do, and how they're going to handle it. But we're going to get into that in a few minutes. We're also going to have Lawton Smalls in just a few minutes. We're also going to talk to the guy that actually told Dick Cheney to go himself.
Uh-oh.
That's going to be exciting. But right now, I want to review a little bit, if we could, because I think a lot of people who are just tuning in might have missed out. Earlier this in this show, we talked to a guy named Hugh Kaufman. Hugh Kaufman is a senior policy analyst with about 35 years at the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and he's talking. He's talking because his agency has been gutted by this administration, not unlike FEMA has been gutted. They have been neutered. They have been they no longer can do their jobs effectively. And what he had to say about what's going on in New Orleans in terms of the toxicity of the water was revelationary. Is that a word? Revelational? Was a revelation to me.
There you go.
Revelatory. There you go.
Yeah, that's revelatory.
Word. Well, I just did a little prose poem, a little free verse, you know, an alliterative exploration of the word revelation. But let's hear from Hugh Kaufman, because we put together a little montage of what he had to say, and I think it'll blow your minds. Is the government being honest with people about the safety of the air and water in New Orleans right now?
No, they're not. All of the oil and chemical companies that own storage tanks, facilities in that area that were flooded or impacted are required to publish with our regional office in Dallas instantly whenever there's a release, whenever there's a breakage from pipelines, from storage tanks, refinery. The regional office, under orders, is not releasing that information to the public. And the Society of Environmental Journalists has sued EPA and the federal government to try and get that information released so the public will see the full magnitude of how much toxic material they are being exposed to in that region of the country.
So, Hugh Kaufman, from the senior policy analyst from the EPA, you're telling me that they have that information. The EPA office in Louisiana has that information, and you are absolutely sure that information is horrendous, but they are keeping it under lock and key because they don't want the people to know the truth of what's really going on down there on a toxic level.
That's correct, and that's why the Society of Environmental Journalists are suing under the Freedom of Information Act to try and get that information.
So the government is actively lying to the people about what is going on there, and that is their policy now.
That's the policy as of last night at 11 o'clock when I went to sleep.
And that is the policy that happened in 9/11 as well, isn't it, you Calvin?
Same policy in 9/11, that's correct. Oh, the heroes went in to try and help, were working for months in there, no respirators, no protective clothing, and now 4 years later, over 75% of those responding heroes are sick as dogs and they're starting to die off, and I'm worried that that's going to happen down the line down there. That's why there are billions of dollars of lawsuits as a result of 9/11 because of the government cover-up.
That was Hugh Kaufman, who we talked to earlier. He's a senior policy analyst with 35 years' experience at the Environmental Protection Agency. It's just mind-blowing, you know, what people don't know about what happened, at Ground Zero at 9/11. You know, right now, you know, even the Special Investigative Committee they put in place to keep in touch with the people that got sick, that the emergency workers down there, the federal workers who were working at Ground Zero around the clock, they were supposed to monitor those people, and add the thousands that were working down there, they've only examined 400 of them.
Well, you know, it's amazing, too, Mark. There were so many volunteers. I'm sure people who were in New York at the time can remember literally the thousands of people who went down to Ground Zero after the towers fell and helped, for example, feed the firemen, transporting goods back, water and food back and forth to the firemen and policemen. The iron workers who were the ones that were, you know, burning their feet on the flaming embers of Ground Zero. A lot of those people are covered by absolutely nothing and have heard from absolutely no one with regard to any injuries that they may have suffered. In an effort, I mean, it's like almost no good deed goes unpunished.
It's unbelievable. And then they tried to take about $125 million back from New York.
Yeah.
Back, because they wanted their money back.
Yeah.
And that money was supposed to be there to take care of people here who might be hurt or sick or whatever. It's just heinous, the amount of cover-up and lies that this administration is capable of. What's also heinous, but beautiful, this is one of the great acts of civil disobedience. Last week, when Dick Cheney was down there doing his own part in trying to restore the image of a fallen president who's fallen in the polls, that's for sure. He was standing on the street, and people who were watching him, on TV, they were watching on CNN, I believe, wasn't it? You were able to see and hear this.
You've got, as I was talking with the mayor. In those areas, one of the things you've got to figure out what to do with all of the debris.
It was just beautiful because, Cheney's just standing there, and all of a sudden you hear just a guy, sounds like he's walking by. Go yourself, Mr. Cheney. And everybody was sort of like, who was that guy? And, of course, the administration said, a protester.
Yep.
A protester. But it turns out this guy does have a name. He's got a job. He's got a face. He's got a story. And like so many others along the Gulf Coast, our next guest lost everything during Hurricane Katrina. And when Dick Cheney came to town last week to survey the damage, our guest let the VP know about his displeasures with the government's recovery efforts. Joining us now from Long Beach, Mississippi, where he's staying with his in-laws, is Dr. Ben Marble, an emergency room physician from Mississippi. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Hey, great job, I got to say, in standing up and go ahead and speak in your mind. I definitely appreciated it.
Well, thanks. I appreciate all the overwhelming support I've received about that.
You're a folk hero, Ben, whether you like it or not. How you doing down there? How's your family doing?
We're doing better. Things are slowly, I don't think anything will ever be the same, after this. But
sure.
Slowly getting back to some semblance of normality.
Did you evacuate?
Yes, I did.
Now, let's just tell our listeners a story of what led up to you, walking by Cheney and telling him to go himself.
Well, I'll try to cut it short.
We've got a couple minutes.
But basically, I'd been going and salvaging things from my home for several days, and a friend of mine was helping me. We were on the way over there. And, basically, we're living, I guess you would call it, under martial law now here.
Uh-huh.
You can't be out after night. So we were shooting video on our way over to the house, and we pulled up to the train tracks. They would not let us cross, and I had crossed there numerous times. That's literally 200 feet from my house,
mm-hmm.
and I had about an eighth a tank of gas in this budget rental truck I had, and they wanted me to go an extra 15 to 20 minutes around, wasting all my gas, and that made me pretty mad. And about that point in time, I saw a caravan of cars. I had no idea who it was, about 20 to 30 black cars pull up, And they honk at me and make me back up, and then they say that nobody can go through, and then they let this caravan go through. So
right.
I'm pretty angry, and I wave the middle finger at them at that point, and then I went ahead and drove around the long route, finally made it back to my house. I heard my neighbor say that the vice president was down the street talking to people,
uh-huh.
and there were two police officers there. I asked them if we could go down, and they said that we could. So me and my friend Jay, we grabbed my video camera and my digital camera, and we started walking down the street.
But these guys thought you were just going to, like, they're like, yeah, the vice president needs your support.
Yeah, I think they probably thought I was, you know, my neighborhood's a predominantly Bush-friendly neighborhood,
uh-huh.
and so I'm sure that's why they came where they did. I lived on 2nd Street, which is one block off of Highway 90, which is the beach.
So you go down there with the video camera?
Correct.
Okay.
They checked my ID, my proof of residency, and then they pat me down and wand us down, and then they let us into the little press conference area. He's giving a press conference. There's reporters everywhere. He's
uh-huh.
talking. My buddy Jay was videotaping, and I snapped a photo, and then I felt like letting him hear the same words that he echoed on that he had spoken to Senator Leahy on the Senate floor.
To go himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got to watch the language. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
And
so you went ahead and said that to the vice president.
I went ahead and said what I said. Yes.
And now his reaction was to try and make a joke. Now what happened to you? Like right after you said that, were you able to go home or?
I was kind of, afraid at that point because, you know, it's a pretty intimidating situation.
Okay.
All these goons around staring at you like
uh-huh.
they want to kill you. And, I thought they were going to tackle me or something else, you know. And so I immediately started walking away from him at that point towards my house. And
quickly.
Smart move.
Correct. And I waved at the guy who had patted me down. I told him to have a nice day, and I walked back to my house.
Uh-huh.
My friend came back. We were loading things up, and then two MPs showed up with their guns pointed in our general direction, said
wow.
they were looking for a guy that fit my description, and they said they, I told them it was probably me they were looking for, and so at that point they said they were going to detain me, and they handcuffed me and put me in a vehicle where, you know, I stayed for about 15 or 20 minutes while they asked me some questions.
So you were taken into a vehicle at gunpoint, handcuffed for saying the F word?
Correct.
What did they ask you?
What were my intentions? What was I doing? Why did I do that? Was I going to hurt anybody? And I told them that I lived in the United States of America. I believe that we have the right to freedom of speech, and if he can say that on the floor of the Senate, then, you know, I can say it in the middle of the worst disaster in the history of our nation.
Well, yeah, I think you did the right thing, and they labeled you a protester in the media, but you're not. You're just a frustrated American who felt mistreated by his administration, spoke his mind, and I guess they released you right after that. They knew that?
Yeah, they went ahead and let me go. They said I, you know, apparently hadn't broken any laws, so they went ahead and let me go. They took my contact info and all that down.
Now, a lot of people may not realize it, but you're an emergency room physician, and you're also playing a rock band, and your rock band is called what?
I'm actually in two bands. One's called Yoon, Y-O-O-N, and the other's called Dr. O.
Okay, and do you do political songs there, Dr. Marble?
Dr. O has a lot of political songs. Yoon's more radio-friendly type music.
Okay, buddy. Okay. Well, this was pretty radio-friendly, most of it. It's okay, buddy.
That's
thanks for talking to us, Ben. You take care of yourself and your family down there.
All right, thank you.
Okay,
thanks
buddy.
A lot.
So it's 18 past the hour. We'll be back to talk about the confirmation hearings a little bit. We'll also have Lawton Smalls is going to be visiting us. And a little later, not much later, though, we're going to talk to Judge Catherine Cryer about the Roberts nomination. It's 18 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Otasa katata matita. Hear my voice, idolaters, snucklers at the teats of beasts, and every guy named Ron in Hoboken. This is MILF Cardinal Milfington of Rapture Watch. And because I always want to know the latest on what Satan and his toad-licking minions are up to, I listen to the Morning Sedition Monday through Friday, every hubdominal, look it up, from 6 to 9 a.m. here on Air America Radio.
22 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Air America's Radio's Morning Sedition. Folks, since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So here now is Planet Push Bureau Chief Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Good morning, Mark. When you serve God, don't spill coffee in his lap.
Okay, very funny. So I guess you saw that FEMA Chief Michael Brown stepped down today, yesterday,
yes,
because of his appalling job of dealing with the hurricane.
Well, poor choice of adjectives, as always, Mark. But
what?
Let me tell you something.
Yeah.
That was a magnificent display of loyalty from Michael Brown. Standing between the president and the malicious liberal media and taking the bullet in the line of fire, just like Clint Eastwood in that
stop
movie.
It.
Sir, let me say this publicly. Brownie, you've done a heck of a job.
Oh, what are you kidding me? Are you kidding me, Lawton? Michael Brown represents maybe the worst case of government incompetence I have ever seen. Ever. The guy was useless, Lawton.
Heck of a job.
No.
Heck of a. Not surprising, since President George W. two-terms mandate Bush is a natural CEO and has an unerring eye for choosing executive material.
Oh.
I mean, he took one look at Michael Brown and said, FEMA chief. No doubt about it.
Come on, man. Lawton Brown got his job only because the old FEMA chief resigned and recommended him. And that was his old college roommate, man. His only experience in disaster relief was mopping up bong water, buddy.
Well, that's hilarious. But you've got to pick up your... You got to pick your friends, Mark.
Uh-huh.
If a leader doesn't pick people he can trust for the big jobs, they'll just wind up disagreeing with him about things that are really important.
Oh, yeah, like what?
Well, like tax cuts, like putting the Ten Commandments in front of the courthouse,
nudity
on cable television,
uh-huh.
Important stuff like that. What if another Terry Schiavo situation comes
up?
You're going to want somebody who will fly in from any vacation destination in the world just to stand next to his president and Jesus
and say
what's expected of him.
But wait, what about experience? Doesn't experience count for anything in public officials, Lawton?
Oh, experience. You mean with some wonk, some 9-to-5-er, some clock puncher, some kind of Al Gore, let's study the data type of deal? No, thank you.
Come on.
Give me loyalty every time. Like I always say, if you're thinking... You're not doing.
Okay, and when, all right. And when Bush does appoint someone who knows what the hell's going on, he forces him out. Look at Colin Powell, my friend.
That proves my point exactly.
What?
Look what all his experience in the war got him. Arguing with the commander-in-chief, talking back, thinking on his own. Colin Powell really needed to know was two words. Yes, sir. And maybe thank you, sir. Mark, it's called a chain of command. Not a noodle of command.
Yeah, Lawton, you're intense lately, buddy. But let me tell you something. All Bush has done is pick a bunch of unqualified ass-kissing cronies who are lazy as he is. And then when we need effective leadership, like right now in the Gulf, those morons screw up everything and regular people pay the price. Then they blame the media. That's Bush's legacy right there, my friend. The culture of incompetence, Lawton.
No one's been more loyal than me, Mark. I've done everything for him. I campaigned for that man day and night.
All right.
I had W tattooed in a private area.
All right, okay.
I killed a man in Costa Rica just for him.
Really?
So where's my cushy government job, huh? I could be the head of FEMA. Why not me? Ambassador to the UN. I'd be great at that. Housing and urban development. I know all about that stuff.
Okay.
Why not me? Why don't he pick me?
Okay, take
I'm as smart as the horse guy.
Take it easy, man.
I get it. And that made it FEMA chief.
You probably are as smart as Brown, okay? You are. You're as smart as Brown. You deserve a job. Jeez, that was crazy.
Can I be FEMA chief? Really?
Yes. Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, thanks.
You all right? Okay.
Loyalty, Mark. You should try it. That'll give your aimless life some direction.
Oh,
it'll
shut
give
up.
You a North Star to navigate to.
Goodbye, Lawton. Goodbye.
North Star. All right, God loves you. Deal with it.
All right. There you go. You know, I'll tell you, lately, Riley, he has been getting a little intense.
Yeah.
It's like it's got a serious, he's always serious because he is who he is, but lately I felt a little fire coming out of Lawton.
Bull is in the china shop.
I'll tell you, some real fire coming out of Lawton Smalls. He'll be there. No, you're not. Lawton is going to be apparently on vacation.
On assignment.
Well, they stifle it. You know, Bush was on vacation and then, you know, he's. But look, you know, we got Catherine Cryer, the host of Court TV's Catherine Cryer Live and the author of Contempt, How the Right is Wronging American Justice. We're going to talk to her a little bit about how these confirmation hearings are beginning to unfold and what she thinks of Roberts and the other nominees that might fill the other gap in the Supreme Court. It's very interesting what happened in those opening comments, you know, yet from all the senators, because all the Republicans were like, hey, you don't have to answer anything. You don't have to.
Yeah.
Don't. And then the Democrats are like, oh, come on. We got to figure out what his point of view is. And he walks in with his kids.
Well, yeah, but the thing that people need to focus on is he got the last word.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're going to talk a lot about that stuff with Catherine Cryer. So stay with us. It's 27 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Edition.
Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. You can come join us live on Friday at Elmo Restaurant. Elmo's on 7th Avenue and 19th, between 19th and 20th here in New York. We'll be there Friday morning from 6 to 9. It'll be fun. Come on down. So the confirmation hearings on John Roberts began yesterday. While our next guest was elected to the bench as a Republican, she feels strongly that Americans need to know how their way of life is at risk with a Bush-appointed Supreme Court. She is the host of Court TV's Catherine Cryer Live and the author of Contempt, How the Right is Wronging American Justice. We are pleased to have with us in our studio Judge Catherine Cryer. Good morning, Judge.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to call you
Hey,
Judge.
For many years, that's what I went by. I didn't have any other name, so I'm actually used
I would hate to let that go. If I was once called judge, I'd make people call me that for the rest of my life.
Or they are held in contempt.
Yeah, there you go. So let's get right into it with this guy, Roberts. I mean, what concerns you the most about Roberts?
Well, now, Roberts is not of that much concern. He, I think, is more in line with a Rehnquist. I'm not opposing conservative justices. I am opposing ultra-conservative. Clarence Thomas, Antonin Scalia are men who basically say our moral biblical values are going to direct the way we rule in cases rather than case law. Now, for all those people out there say, but of course we want moral judges. Our law has been moral for 215 years.
Right.
It is not absent of values.
Moral does not have to be connected to religion.
Exactly.
Right.
But unfortunately, we have an agenda going on out there right now that basically says we want our biblical version, our version of the Bible, to basically guide and direct judicial decisions, and that's going to change things dramatically in this country.
But the big concern is, for a lot of people, is that some people say we don't know enough about Roberts' real opinions, and I have a concern that he's going to get in there, and who really knows what the hell he's going to do in terms of, could he just become an ultra-conservative out of nowhere? Don't you fear that?
See, you don't know with any of the judges over the years.
Okay.
Wonderfully, I think, though, most of them, when they don the robes, particularly on the high court, understand the enormity of their responsibility, and you actually see a moderating of a lot of views, and that doesn't mean that they're letting horrible things happen in the country. They're not abandoning values, etc. But in fact, they realize that the lives of millions of people are really in their hands in certain respects, and I think they're more careful. Now, this guy, the concern you may have, things like civil liberties and obviously abortion still is at the top of many people's agendas. I think those issues need to be probed, but I don't think you're going to get any information publicly that would lead a Democratic revolt over this guy and keep him off the bench.
Well, I hope that you're right in that a judge will face the enormity of his responsibilities, but, you know, judging by the president that appointed him, this is not a president that necessarily stood up and lived up to the enormity of his responsibilities.
Well, now think about it, though. David Souter, which everybody is the Republicans are complaining about, the ultra-right is complaining about, Anthony Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are Republican appointees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But now you see that Anthony Kennedy was actually called the most dangerous man in America by I don't want to pin it on Jerry Falwell, but one of those one of those guys because he referenced in an opinion that most places on the planet don't believe in executing juveniles. Now, because he said something about other countries and their opinions, all of a sudden he was deciding our cases based upon foreign law, and he is, quote, the most dangerous man in America, which is ludicrous.
Well, I mean, wasn't Earl Warren, you know, a notorious liberal chief justice? Wasn't he appointed by Eisenhower? I think he was.
Yeah, he was governor of California. Good Republican.
Yeah.
But in fact, you've seen in the last sort of 30 years, each sort of segment of Supreme Court history talks about different areas of the law.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 20s and 30s, a lot of corporate law, a lot of big business was dominating. But by the time you got through the Depression and on into the 60s and 70s, you've really had a focus on individual rights. So judges today, those are hot button issues, all of a sudden are all liberal because they recognize and appreciate the Bill of Rights in this country.
Oh, by the way, it was Dobson.
James Dobson.
James
Dobson. Okay,
yes.
Okay.
So if you don't feel that that Roberts is a tremendous threat because he's just filling Rehnquist's shoes, what about the next Supreme Court nominee?
That's the battle.
That's going to be a real battle, because if that is an ultra-conservative or even a hard right conservative, we're in trouble because there's no balance.
Well, people need to understand how much trouble we're really in. And they think that it's all, okay, we're talking about gays and abortion again. No. There is an agenda that when you examine goes much deeper. We're talking about minimum wage laws. We're talking about workers' rights. We're talking about environmental regulations. And I'm sorry, I think there are a lot of conservatives out there that care whether or not our air is filthy and our water is polluted. So we're talking about all sorts of things that are running beneath the radar when we think about what is this agenda that they seem to be exercising.
Now, in your book, Contempt, How the Right is Wronging American Justice, we're talking to Judge Catherine Cryer, by the way. You've got a chapter here on the nominees and mm-hmm. who you think is going to be nominated for this
who
other.
Could be,
who
yeah.
could be. Uh-huh. And so why don't you share some of that with us and our listeners and who are the worst of them?
Well,
let me guess. The worst, and I haven't looked at this, Michael Luttig.
Well, I think Michael Luttig is way up on my list of someone I would not feel at all comfortable in sitting on the Supreme Court. And again, we're talking, and Edith Jones from the Fifth Circuit, my home circuit. There's some of these individuals who, again, have made it very clear that their own worldview shall dominate their rulings. And their worldview is, you know, is basically to have, again, as I said, their biblical interpretation.
A theocracy.
A theocracy in this country, which is not what the Supreme Court's supposed to be all about.
It's a democracy killer, obviously, and even any sort of slight movement towards that is diminishing other people's voices.
Well, that's right, and I find it outrageous that we're hearing that judges are these atheistic, godless, America-hating individuals, when in fact they're these dedicated civil servants that have basically given their lives, because the judges don't make what most lawyers make, you know? Have given their lives to really defending the Constitution and supporting this country, and I just think it's outrageous.
Let's talk about the politics of this whole thing for a minute. It does not look like the Democrats are going to put up any formidable opposition to Judge Roberts. Do you think they're smart in letting him go through, but really setting a very high bar on the other justices? Of course, we've also got an 85-year-old justice, John Paul Stevens, who nobody talks about, who may retire himself. That would be three.
I say in the book, and this was before, you know, Rehnquist, bless his heart, passed away, but I said President Bush is going to get a couple of nominations, we expect, during his remaining time in office. And yes, I think whether it's Justice Stevens and there's some health problems elsewhere on the court, I do think that Sandra Day O'Connor is not the only one. But what we're seeing now and the questions that are asked to Judge Roberts, we need to pay attention to, because I think that is the prelim for the next nomination.
Mm-hmm.
Should he nominate a woman?
Well, I'd like to see that. I think it's important, whether it's an Hispanic, whether it's a woman. And it's not, let's just have diversity for diversity's sake. Mm-hmm. But I think that there are voices in this country that would like to be represented. But if the woman and Judge Jones, I'm sorry, if the woman's Edith Jones, I'm going to have a real problem with
that. What about Priscilla Owen?
I'm going to have a real problem with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about the momentum that has gotten the country to this point now. I mean, you have a chapter in your book called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, and I've talked about it on this show, that this is really the manifestation of a 30-year process of them taking over the judicial wing. It's a plan. It's been a goal for a long time. Tell me about who the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse are and what it means to this country.
Well, I think the one that I think about the most, you've got Boyden Gray, you know, you've got several, but Ed Meese is is the one that I found the most outrageous.
Former Attorney General under Reagan.
He's been around forever.
Yeah, and he's still leading the wing behind the scenes. This is a man who in the 80s said basically that the incorporation doctrine, which was a doctrine in the 40s that said, you know what, the Bill of Rights actually apply to the states. Mm-hmm. You know, the states have to respect the Bill of Rights. And it was the first time that they took this national document and said it applied to the states. He says, oh, no, it doesn't. And that's one of the parts of their agenda. Can you imagine? The states can discriminate at will. They don't have to respect freedom of speech, mm-hmm. the freedom of assembly, the search and seizure laws, all the rest of this business, because he said it's not really legitimate that the incorporation doctrine applies.
Hmm.
So these are the kinds of things these people want to do. And it also goes to the economic agendas. And we need to understand the ramifications are so much broader than people think.
So if this court becomes completely conservative, and what I don't understand,
ultra conservative,
is that this opens the door to really frightening, heinous things that could be done, like you're saying, on a state level. There's no reason not to think that this country could not resemble a totalitarian or fascist state eventually, mm-hmm. if this momentum continues. Am I wrong?
Well, you're absolutely correct, and I find it so frightening that people don't get it. As you said, if you go back and read the 50s and 60s, there was a clear agenda, and I have so much respect politically for a group, for an organization that can keep their nose to the grindstone and work on this, because right now we have a very conservative Congress, a very conservative White House, and there's only one branch, semi-independent branch left.
And these are but this branch, the thing that really frightens me is what I call the Christo-fascist zombie brigade, is that there are, you know, these organizations in place that mislead, I think, you know, thousands and thousands of people into the idea that they're being Christian. When they're really not. I mean, these are political operations. Am I wrong?
Well, you're absolutely correct. But if you put the Bible up front, mm-hmm. then people think that they're fighting for family values and all the good and just and moral things in this country, when in fact the agenda is certainly there, but much, much deeper.
Right.
When you've been a judge.
Yeah.
How do you feel when you hear religious leaders, in some cases, politicians and others, slamming the judiciary, and in some cases, you know, likening some of the violence that's been taking place against judges and making that the judge's fault?
Oh, I cringe. I absolutely cringe. And as I say in the book, I'm sure there may be some Muslim judges out there. I don't know any that are not, you know, Jewish or Christian. I don't know any atheists out there. And I actually talk about that. The percentage of declared atheists in this country is, so let's say,
point zero.
And yet, all of a sudden, we're hearing from these religious leaders that our judges are, in fact, these atheistic, gay-loving, communistic-inspired, and it's just somebody's got to stand up and say, enough.
Yeah, because some of these groups or the fringe of these groups are encouraging people to be violent against judges. They're encouraging people to not assess the judges that you're talking about as being, this is the real activism, are the ones that they want to put in now.
Well, absolutely. They talk about activist judges, and of course, you're supposed to equate that with liberal. You know, the two get interchanged here. But activist judges, the most activist court we have ever had is the Rehnquist Court.
Right.
And I'm saying this based upon the fact that they have overturned more congressional legislation than any other Supreme Court in history, 33 pieces of legislation since 95. That's the definition of an activist court. So
sure
let's be real clear what we're talking about.
All right. Well, God, it was really great talking to you. Catherine Cryer, the book is Contempt, How the Right is Wronging American Justice. It was a pleasure to talk to you. It's 46 past the hour. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
46 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning's Edition. We'll be back. I think my father's here, so maybe he'll come in and make me feel weird.
Hi, this is Dar Williams. After a long night of electric guitar solos, pyrotechnics, trashed hotel rooms, and bad eating, I listen to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
All right, let's put this thing down. It's 51 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yep.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. Hey, people, we're going to be broadcasting live from Elmo Restaurant this Friday. Elmo is on 7th Avenue between 19th and 20th. We'll be there from 6 to 9 this Friday. We'll have some coffee for you, some T-shirts and things. Mark and I will be there. We'll have funny guests. It'll be fun because it's fun when we go out and do it in the real world.
In the real world.
Isn't it, Riley?
With real people.
People come up, they give us vegetables. You didn't take any home.
Oh, that's right. I didn't,
you didn't take home
vegetables.
Your vegetables. Lynn brings the vegetables from her garden.
Okay,
in Queens,
sorry, Lynn.
And I got to bring them home. And not that I, she made my cats fresh catnip.
Really?
Oh, boy. That
oh,
was,
man.
That was something. They went nuts. Anyways, look, hey, I keep saying people or folks. Where'd that come from? When did that weird habit start there, Kayla? By the way, it's Kayla's birthday. Happy birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday.
Here we go. New York, folks, is going to be a little crazy if you're in the New York area. Not only is it election day or voting day today, For the primaries, New York has gone into security gridlock with 170 world leaders descending on the city for the United Nations Summit and General Assembly, which marks the 60th anniversary of the founding of the world body. The police commissioner here said this is going to be like no other one. The security is going to be insane. They're closing rivers. They're closing streets. The president's coming in today. He'll probably walk in with flood water actually on his pants just to make it seem like he's doing something.
Genuine, authentic.
Sitting in the room is the guy from his loins I came. Is that what it is? Pop, it's my father, Barry Maron's in town. Come close to the microphone. It's not going to come close to you. Yeah, just edge up to it. It's nice to see you, Dad.
Thank you.
You just got into town when?
Midnight on Sunday.
Yeah, and what have you been doing? What's the big plan?
Well, I've been visiting down South Jersey, sat on the beach a little bit.
South Jersey.
How far down?
Asbury Park area.
I went down to Ortley Beach, which is near Seaside Heights.
That's right.
Last
right
year.
Down. Yeah. It was good.
Yeah.
I got to talk intellectually with my sister and my brother-in-law. It was a fun time.
Did you stun them with your intellectualism?
Well, they asked me questions about medical issues, which I love to discuss, and we did.
By the way, I got this weird thing on my foot. Can you? his eyes wide up. He's like, "Oh, good, I can connect. I know how that works. That's a foot."
I spend most of my time just conceiving and talking about the life in the medical world.
Well, you used to be, people don't realize, you used to be a surgeon and a very good surgeon, and you're a little disgusted with the way medicine is structured now. You find the HMO structure a little disconcerting, eh?
It's very disappointing.
Uh-huh.
Very disappointing.
Because there's a certainly a fear. Not only do they stop doctors from practicing properly because there are certain limitations they put on them, but they almost make, it's almost like we were talking about with that guy today, about FEMA and about the EPA, is that the HMOs, they take away the doctor's ability to make medical decisions.
Worse than that, they take away the doctor's time to discuss the true picture of the patient's problems and discuss the pros and cons of treatment and instruct them in what the ideal is, what they want to have done. Everything is on a time schedule now, and people are really shortchanged when visiting their doctor. Patients should go to their doctor with a list of questions, and they want to research their questions so they really get their answers. And if the doctor doesn't give them their answers, you got the wrong doctor.
There you go.
Wow.
Boy, I think my dad's going to be running for office. That's pretty. So what are we going to do? We're going to go out afterwards. We're going to go to Second Avenue Deli. What's the big plan today?
I'm going to move for some good New York deli.
Isn't that weird? Uh-oh. It's interesting that when you grow up on the East Coast and then you move somewhere else, the things you start to crave are strange. You're like barley soup and corned beef. That's what you start to crave. You're sitting in New Mexico going, what does my life need?
But, you know, Second Avenue and a couple of those other places, cats, they used to deliver all over the world at one time.
Really? They would fly corned beef to London and whatnot?
They had, cats used to have a sign in their window saying, send a salami to your boy in the army. From World War II.
Your father, my grandfather, drove me. That's the first time I went to cats, actually, when I was like maybe 8 or 9. He was living in Bayonne, New Jersey. You know, a lot of people
don't
know
Bayonne.
A lot of people don't know this about me, that my roots are in New Jersey, deeply in New Jersey. You hear that, Dan Pashman? I'm from New Jersey, too. You see that? So what happens is your father, Ben, my grandfather, wakes me up. I don't know why he woke me up. He came home from work. It must have been 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. I'm sleeping. He wakes me up to drive me into the city to go to Katz's. It was a very weird experience. But it was like that. You walk in. I remember the first time you walk in, just like rows and rows of salami.
Yeah.
So are you happy to be here?
Yeah, it's enjoyable. We really look forward to walking around New York. We like to walk from really Harlem to the Battery, you know, one day just up and down Fifth Avenue, up Madison Avenue.
Maybe we can go find George Bush and tell him to off today. Hey, for those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. FEMA Director Michael Brown tenders his resignation. Mathematicians at MIT are still trying to calculate just how incompetent someone has to be in order to be forced out of the Bush administration. Brown is going to take some time off to relax, ride horses, and avoid thinking about all the people he's killed. Terrorist Abu Musab al-Zarqawi called Hurricane Katrina an answer to Muslims' prayers. Christian fundamentalists immediately disagreed, saying Katrina was God's vengeance against Louisiana voodoo and abortion clinics, and that al-Zarqawi really needs to get his wraps of God straight. Wow, two oofs. That's oof. Two oofs from Riley.
And nothing from your father.
That's all right. He's thinking about himself. Sony gives a... He's like, I wonder how I just sounded. I sound stupid. Am I all right? All right. Sony gives a $3.6 million record deal to a 12-year-old boy. This is the most a preteen has made in the music industry since an unidentified boy got $15 million from Michael Jackson. Except he was not being... He was being paid not to sing. Phrase of the day, just working into conversation. As of right now, no one is in charge of FEMA, and you'll notice everything feels pretty much the same. Wake up, sheeple. This was the first big test of Homeland Security, and they're gonna have to take an incomplete, my friends. Wow. That took a lot to get out. So, Dad, we're going to eat breakfast. Tomorrow we'll be here, Riley.
Tomorrow we've got, yes, Harry Reams.
I can't believe that. And that singer, she's great.
Yeah, Regina Spektor is going to be performing live. And a call from Future Mark.
Excellent.
Your dad ought to have fun with that one. Good one, Marin.
Good show, Riley.
Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.